The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, today John Williams joins us, and he's always fascinating because of his views on government statistics and their analysis.
Well, and this is particularly helpful because when you go to the mass media, the view today is that we're actually in economic recovery. You have signs of that. December's trade data was better, revisions to the fourth quarter retail sales, and we've got home sales, auto sales, a couple of things that are picked out and said, hey, look at this, this is great. He takes a different view and says, yes, but if you actually study that statistic, you find that there's a high degree of manipulation within that statistic, and it doesn't say what you think it says. You have to look at the assumptions. You have to look at how they derive the conclusions that they're coming to, rather than just advertise those headline numbers. So again, I love the conversations that we've had with John, and would encourage anyone who's interested in getting to know him, get to know his work, to go to shadowstats.com. Shadowstats.com is where he publishes a weekly newsletter.
Right.
That's, of course, a paid service. And you want to, as we explore today, I hope, the issue of hyperinflation, get to his website and read his report, a very extensive report on hyperinflation.
You know, David, sometimes you have to have a mathematician to tell you that the math doesn't work. And, you know, there's a lot of things out there that just give guys opinions, gut feelings, that type of thing. John doesn't do that. He says the math doesn't work, so let me show you why.
John, it's great to have you back on the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. There's many things that for either a new listener or someone who perhaps hasn't followed what's happening in the economy as closely as they could have. Of course, we all have many, many things to pay attention to in life, and these are very important, but also very detailed issues. Where would you catch someone up? What's the big picture here? Let's start with the macro issues, things that you think someone needs to know, cannot ignore, and has to have in front of them now as we move into 2013, 2014, and 2015.
Number one would be that the economy has not recovered, and it's not about to recover. The underlying basics with consumer liquidity show that the consumer has no ability to drive a sustainable growth in consumption. The reason people have seen in the headlines a reported recovery is that the government understates inflation. That's another very big point, because if you're, most people, when they try to estimate inflation or look for inflation, they're looking at it from the standpoint of setting investment goals or what their income needs to change by. Because of the inflation understatement, that affects the way the economy gets overstated. If you use too low rate of inflation in adjusting your economic numbers get overstated. And the third issue, and these combine into a rather unfortunate circumstance, is that when you look at GAAP-based accounting, the way that a major corporation usually would report its operations, the federal government is bankrupt and running an annual deficit to close to $7 trillion. That includes the year-to-year change in the unfunded liabilities, but that's, the number there is net present value. That's the cash you have to have in hand today to cover the shortfall into the future. Nobody's looking at bringing that into balance, and if they don't bring it into balance, you very rapidly will see the dollar collapse here, and we're going to go into a hyperinflation.
John Stanley Druckenmiller, who's a retired hedge fund manager, really an extraordinary person, last week laid bare this particular issue, the long-term liabilities, saying that basically the immediate debt obligations, we think of, you know, 16, 17 trillion current debts, were insignificant compared to the long-term obligations, Social Security, Medicare. In essence, he was castigating today's seniors for not pushing through reforms to avoid the direct transference from tomorrow's seniors to the current class of retirees, and basically saying we are so on a path to perdition. I mean, that this is just not sustainable. And I think you're looking at the same thing. The $6.6 trillion factors back, that net present value factors back into the equation, not just the spending deficit today in real time of $1.1 trillion, but our obligations of 6.6, as you say, close to 7 trillion. So you're basically arguing the economy is not in recovery. What else would you focus on for someone who's just coming into the conversation as to issues that they need to understand? Perhaps you can come back to that issue of understated inflation and expand on that a little bit, because I think for most people, they're looking at tame inflation today. There really is no sign of inflation today. And so why be concerned?
Well, let me just backtrack a minute there. One other very significant implication of the weaker economy, and again, this right now you've got a sequestration in place. You've got, in theory, some kind of budget negotiations going on between the parties. There are going to be negotiations over expansion of the debt limit. All the forecasts going forward on the budget deficit, Treasury funding, are based on underlying economic assumptions. And if the economic growth is weaker than they're projecting, which I assure you it is going to be, and it is, all the budget projections get blown away. Any hopes of balancing even the cash-based deficit or what they're talking about, the sequestration, is just a statistical error, plus or minus, given their underlying economic assumptions. And here's where the problem comes in with the inflation. We go back, let's say, to the 1960s and before. Go back to when the CPI was first used in the water union contracts for purposes of cost of living adjustment. And the concept there was to measure inflation in terms of what you spent out of pocket. That had never been an issue. And in terms of inflation, what was needed in the way of a cost of living adjustment to maintain a constant standard of living? What was the cost of living of maintaining a constant standard of living? To do that, to come up with the estimate, the Bureau of Labor Statistics had, since it started its official publication of the CPI back in 1913, but also back in estimates in the 1880s and other indices that had been used back into the 1700s, even the 1600s, the way it had always been looked at was measuring the cost of a fixed basket of goods. Very simplistically, let's say they'd price out a pound of beef, a gallon of gas, a loaf of bread. If that was your basket, they'd price it out this year. They'd price out that same basket next year. Whatever the price of the basket had gone up, that was your inflation. That's how much your income would have had to have gone up, or your investment returns would have had to have been, in order to be able to maintain the ability to buy that same basket of goods, to maintain that existing standard of living. In the early 90s, Alan Greenspan and head of the Council of Economic Advisors, Michael Boskin, began putting forth the concept that the Consumer Price Index, which was the government's headline inflation measure, overstated inflation. And if only they could get a more accurate number, it would enable them to reduce the budget deficit, because a more accurate number would show lower inflation, and that would mean that it would reduce the cost of living adjustments on programs such as Social Security, on and on. You ask them, why was the CPI overstated? Their rationale simply was, well, let's say steak goes up too much in price, people will buy more hamburger. And then if they buy more hamburger, their cost of living will be less. Well, while that's true, that's not a cost of living that's needed to maintain a constant standard of living. If you're maintaining a constant standard of living, you still have the ability to buy steak. You don't have to buy the hamburger. So they were looking to destroy the concept of the fixed basket, and they did. Actually, before that, they'd started to introduce nebulous quality changes in goods that people didn't recognize, but which computer programs that modeled what they called hedonic quality adjustments would come in and say, well, this product's gone up in quality, and therefore we're going to reduce the inflation on it. The effect there was to significantly reduce inflation on a lot of goods. I'll give you an example. I have a friend who just had to purchase a new washing machine after 30 years. She'd bought the top-of-the-line Sears unit 30 years ago. Best she could do today, top-of-the-line, would be to get a machine that would last 10 years. The fact that the lifetime of the machine has dropped significantly is not modeled into the pricing of the washing machines, but the fact that it now has a digital display as opposed to, in terms of time, as opposed to a knob that would turn back and show you how many minutes you have left. They've made quality adjustments based on that. And most of the inflation that has been seen in just what does it take to buy a top-of-the-line washing machine is not there in the CPI numbers. But and that's because of these hedonic quality adjustments. So you're not getting the out-of-pocket expenditure with the hedonic quality adjustments. And because of changing the price index from a fixed weight index, where you had a fixed basket of goods, to what they call a substitution-based index, you've lost, since 1990, roughly 3 percentage points of year-to-year inflation, and since 1980, you're looking at something in the vicinity of 7 percentage points.
It's basically compounding against you negatively.
Well, yes, and in fact, had the changes not been made at the time that it was raised by Greenspan and Boskin, the changes that were made then to alter the payments of Social Security, that was done successfully from their standpoint, Social Security checks should be double what they are today. People think I'm kidding on that. I'm not kidding, and if you think about it, if you read the papers, if you look at the budget negotiations of this last year or so, not that there's been anything significant that's come out of it, but the one thing that they did agree on, and now have backed off of because of public protest, was to reduce Social Security cost of living adjustments by using a new CPI measure.
A new CPI?
What they did before did not make the CPI fully substitution-based. They have another measure they've been publishing for over 10 years now called the chained CPIU, which is fully substitution-based and have introduced, would further reduce the reporting of the CPI. But unlike the current CPI, which once they report it, it's fixed, this one gets revised over 2 years. I don't see how they could physically really put this into place, but enough people who raised protests here that it was destroying the concept of the cost of living that they seem to have backed off. But they've done this before. They did this back in the 90s, and there have been ongoing efforts here back through the 80s to reduce the CPI. So putting this all together, what this means is from the consumer standpoint, if you're living on something that's based on the CPI, if you're paying, let's say you're paying rent, and your rent's escalated by the CPI, you're making out like a bandit. The landlord on the other side is having a difficult time. If your salary, Social Security payment, or if you've targeted your investment return based on the government's inflation numbers, you're not keeping up with inflation. You're getting hurt, and that's because you're using a number that is too low.
This also applies when you're talking about GDP, industrial production. If you're understating inflation, then aren't you really playing with the numbers, almost overstating GDP, industrial production? I mean, there's a ripple effect, and this gets to your point of the reported recovery is looking at a basic assumption that's underappreciated. This is your point on inflation. They're claiming quite the opposite, that they are overstating inflation, and you're claiming that it's understated, and that makes their numbers look better, and that there's actually a motive for them to have their numbers look better from a political standpoint.
Well, they have, it's a matter of how they define inflation and cost of living. They're defining it for the individual, using it from an income standpoint, that the individual is not looking for a measure of maintaining a constant standard of living. That's nonsense. There's no value for an individual to an inflation measure that doesn't do that. From the economic standpoint, the hedonic adjustments in particular have had devastating effect on the GDP. The GDP, as it's popularly reported, is adjusted for inflation. The idea behind taking inflation out is that when you then see the changes in the GDP, if you've taken out the proper amount of inflation and if you've seasonally adjusted well, what you're seeing in the change is a measure of how the economy is actually doing. If you use too low a rate of inflation, you understate inflation, it overstates the resulting inflation-adjusted growth. Now, when the U.S. first started using these hedonic adjustments, the rest of the world didn't sign on to it, including Japan and Germany. The effect was the U.S. GDP looked a lot stronger than what you were seeing in Japan and Germany. They have since moved to using it, at least partially. They don't use it in all the same areas. But part of the reason that the Japanese economy looked so bad relative to the United States was because they weren't calculating their GDP on the same basis. In like manner, the U.S. had not introduced the hedonic adjustments, we would have seen much weaker economic growth. And what the difference it makes right now, allowing for 2 percentage points of understated hedonic quality adjustment inflation in the GDP. You look at the formal GDP, economy started turning down December of 2007. It plunged through 2008 into 2009. Middle of 2009, it started turning higher again. And it actually fully recovered. It exceeded the level seen before December 2007. Back in the fourth quarter of 2011, and it just kept going higher and higher. It's now well above where it had been going into the recession. Now, what's funny about that is that you're not seeing that pattern with any other major economic series, and that's an impossibility if the GDP and the other series are accurate. They should move together. The GDP is based on other people's reporting, and it's just not there. If you adjust for the overstatement due to the hedonic quality adjustments, what happens is the GDP starts turning down early in 2006, and that's coincident when you start to see the problems in the construction industry. And it weakens into 2007. Then it plunges through 2008 into 2009, does hit a bottom in the middle of 2009, but then it basically bottom bounces. It's stagnant at a low level of activity. It doesn't recover. And I know I have a client who has a sales that generally move very closely to the GDP levels. And the only problem is what we're talking to, you know, that's not happening now. It used to. But we haven't rebounded the way the GDP does. I showed him how the GDP looks when you adjust for the inflation gimmicks. He said, yep, that's our sales pattern. We've not seen an economic recovery, and now the economy is beginning to turn down again. There's a reason why we've not had an economic recovery. Aside from the misreporting, there are underlying fundamentals here. If things don't make sense in terms of what you're seeing, and I can tell you that the average guy has a pretty good sense of what's going on, much better than the quality of what you see out of the government. You talk to anyone, Main Street USA, people who are out in the business world, they know how their business is going. They know if they're employed or unemployed, if their friends are unemployed or employed. And I think you'll find that the general consensus is that the economy has been a lot weaker than the government's been reporting. Inflation's higher, unemployment's higher. It's all a matter of how the government defines it versus the common experience. But here's the rub. Here's where you've got something that has got the economy constrained, and nobody in Washington's looking at changing it. That's consumer income. If you look at average weekly earnings, and this is on the production side, you have, and this is average on a, you know, on a personal basis, this is per person. That peaked in 1972, 1973. We're down 10 to 14% since then, depending upon where you're looking at it. If you use my inflation estimates, which back out what the government's done, it's just been in general decline. But as the government reports it, it is still in downturn. It leveled off, and now it's turning down again. As a result of that, as earnings fell, increasingly, where back in the early 70s, you'd be more inclined to have a household where one person worked, has been going to work, the wife staying home with the kids. Increasingly, the households became one households where two people work. And they did that out of economic necessity. Of course, there were a lot of social changes that accompanied that. But this restructured our society. Now, if you look at household income, again, this is using the government's numbers out of the Census Bureau. Because the Census Bureau last reported it. They report it once a year with the annual poverty survey. So the most recent number they have is for 2011. And adjusted for the Consumer Price Index, CPIU, the median household income, meaning the middle level, that's the same level it was back in 1967. Some former census people have started a company called Centier Research, and they now publish that number on a monthly basis. And what you'll see is that where the income on a monthly basis fell through the recession, when the recession supposedly ended, the income kept falling. Now it's bottom bouncing, but it's well below where it was during the recession. And again, this is actually based on the broader annual numbers put out by the government, below where you were 40-plus years ago. The problem is that if income doesn't grow, and I'm talking income adjusted for inflation, there's no way that consumption can grow. Unless there's sustained growth in income, there cannot be sustained growth in consumption. Income drives consumption. Now, you can buy or borrow a little bit of consumption from the future through debt expansion. And that's what Greenspan encouraged for decades, encouraging people to take on debt, to use debt to make up the shortfall in their standard of living. And that's what collapsed in 2008. But up through 2008, most of the growth that they'd seen in the economy was based on debt expansion, not on healthy growth in income. Now, after the 2008 crisis, consumers don't have the borrowing ability that they once had, but they still have the income problem. And as a result, they cannot support positive growth in consumption. They can't support a renewed boom in the housing industry. And until those areas are addressed, there's no hope of an economic rebound. So we have a lengthy period of time here ahead of us where the economy is going to be down to stagnant. And that's very bad news for things such as the budget deficit and in turn for government borrowing. And for the government to borrow money, it needs to have good credit, and people are willing to lend it money. And when people look at the gap-based deficit, and it's beyond containment, I mean, right now, the deficit for last year was $6.6 trillion. In perspective, you have no ability to contain that. You could raise taxes, we could take 100% of wages and salaries. You'd still be in deficit. You could cut every penny of government spending except for Social Security and Medicare. I mean, eliminate the entire military budget. You're still in deficit. Conclusion from that is, one, you're not going to get out of this by raising taxes. In fact, I'll contend that we're at that tipping point where the higher taxes actually become counterproductive, where the revenues don't rise with that because of what the higher taxes do to the economy and slowing the economy. And from a spending standpoint, they have to reorganize and make stable, to make financially sound, all the government social programs. If they don't, what happens is the government will end up, as most governments do, when they can't raise adequate money, either through taxes or borrowing, and they won't be borrowing here much longer as they have been unless the Federal Reserve does the lending, which the Fed has started to do. They'll have to effectively print the money. And as they print the money, that creates inflation. How do you print the money? Well, the Federal Reserve buys the Treasury debt. We're getting to that point where we're very close to another crisis, one that's going to be worse than what we saw in 2008. And I think there's some risk of things getting very dangerous in the next couple of months. I'm not saying it's going to happen the next couple of months, but there's high risk there with the way that people in Washington are behaving. They're not doing anything to meaningfully address the deficit. If anything, they're sending a signal that they're not going to do it. Global markets have been patient, but they're running out of patience.
John, hyperinflation is a hot topic and one which you've spent a lot of time digesting. You see this as a near certain outcome. You've just sort of given the underlying case or built towards that. It seems that most people are concerned, given the amount of credit that has been created, that there might be a collapse in credit and that looks more like a deflation. Everyone has piled into bonds over the last several years. The tail risk, if you will, has been well insured on the deflation side. But on the inflation or hyperinflationary side, you are amongst a dwindling few people with a real concern there. And we would agree with that there are higher and higher probabilities of a super or hyperinflationary outcome. Is there anything else that you'd want to add to the mix as you're sort of building that case for hyperinflation?
Well, very simply, it's inevitable. Barring the U.S. government working out a way of bringing its house into fiscal order. And from what we've seen in the people running the system at the moment, there's not a chance of that. They're not going to make any political decisions that will affect the major social programs, Social Security, Medicare. Not going to happen. So that it's without that happening, the system is doomed to hyperinflation. The question then becomes one of timing. Originally, I thought this would come to a head at the end of the current decade. I've advanced my estimate in recent years to 2014. Next year, I still look at that. I view it as a virtual certainty here. It's an after effect of what happened in 2008. People tend to forget 2008 now, but remember, we had a panic there. We had a crisis. The financial system was on the brink of absolute collapse. They were not kidding. They saw that happening. They created the circumstance. But once they had created the circumstance and looking into the abyss and not wanting to see the system fail, they created, spent, lent, guaranteed whatever they had to do with money in order to keep the system from collapsing. Those who look at deflation, they're afraid of a debt collapse. A debt collapse does not, per se, create deflation. What Bernanke had feared back in 2008 was, I think, something along the lines of a 1930s-style deflation that resulted directly from the collapse of the banks. As the banks collapsed, depositors lost their money. You didn't have the FDIC then. So as their money was disappeared, the money supply collapsed. The money supply dropped by a third over a period of time, about paralleled the pace of deflation. In today's environment, where they made the decision in 2008 to do whatever was needed to prevent that from happening, that they set in place a mechanism that effectively, again, assures us of hyperinflation. We see the Fed today monetizing Treasury debt. Now, the banks aren't lending it out, but when they monetize the Treasury debt, it actually pushes that cash into the system. What the banks do with that then that may be something else. But right now, as that's pushed into the system, it's actually beginning to spike the money supply growth a little bit. You have a circumstance there where the rest of the world right now is looking very seriously at dumping the dollars. We had, as you go over the last couple of years, we'd reached points of dollar panic, and different things were done to stabilize the dollar. But the big holders of the dollar have been giving the U.S. the benefit of the doubt, giving them time to work things around, to find a way of making things stable, to assure them that the long-term sovereign solvency issue is not a concern for the United States. The United States has not only not done anything in that area, it's actually made it worse. All the money spent did nothing to turn the economy. It did not fundamentally solve the banking system crisis. Our banking system still is in trouble. If it were not in trouble, it would be lending normally, and we'd be seeing extraordinary money supply growth, or the Fed would be pulling the funds from the system. So what happens here, the world, as I'm looking at it, is viewing the U.S. waiting for some action here that indicates the U.S. is going to be solvent in 10 years. It's not doing that. As this terrible circus that's going on in Washington continues, I think you're going to see an extraordinarily negative reaction in the global markets, dumping of the dollar, which in turn will be reflected in higher oil and gasoline prices, meaning to spike the inflation here, dumping of foreign-held U.S. treasuries and other dollar-denominated assets, all of which will give birth to an inflation that will push us into hyperinflation in 2014.
A question for you, John. The idea that somehow the precious metals bull market that has grown over the last 10, 12 years is over, certainly in the minds of many investors, sub-30 silver, sub-$1,600 gold, you know, using a declining oil price today, whether it's WTI or Brent, at least over the last several weeks to months, there's this idea that maybe inflation is tame. Maybe there's no reason to be concerned. You look at the inflation-sensitive areas, and, you know, bonds have still held up very well. We've seen a little uptick in yields, but wouldn't bonds be telling us that inflation was around the corner if those things were coming? In fact, when you come to the gold and silver market, you've suggested that if you adjusted for inflation, just using the CPI, the traditional standard measure, assuming that it had veracity, we wouldn't have seen peak numbers, not 850, 875, but we haven't reached peak numbers until we've exceeded $2,516, or for silver, closer to $146. Help us understand kind of what we're looking at in terms of a market dynamic. Gold's been in a correction for 16 to 17 months. The market is just about convinced that we are, in fact, in the context of economic recovery. And of course, they'll look at trade data, December's trade data, revisions from fourth quarter retail sales. You know, they'll pick and choose a few economic statistics, increased home sales, auto sales, you know, as evidence that the consumer's coming back. Maybe we don't need gold and silver as an insurance policy against inflation, super or even hyperinflation. Maybe you can just respond to that from your gut.
Yeah, well, let me put it this way. The gold is generally poo-pooed by Wall Street more often than not because a lot of the people there don't get a commission on its sales. I'm looking at physical gold generally for holding here. And if you look at it over the last decade, despite its the current malaise, it still has done a lot better than stocks. The thing is that with the gold, with any of these markets, you get a lot of short-term volatility. It's an enemy of the state as far as the central banks are concerned. Anything they can do to knock it down in price, they will. I think that's why you had the that last Fed minutes so worded to try and maybe hit gold and boost the dollar a little bit before you get into the market reactions that will follow the terrible budget problems ahead. You raised a number of issues there. Let me just hit them real quickly. In terms of Treasury yields, that's an absolute nonsense market right now because the Federal Reserve is buying all the issuance or pretty much close to it. So it's a rigged market. You have a very big buyer there that's your buyer of last resort. And as the inflation does kick in, market forces will just get worse and worse. And the Fed's going to be buying more and more. And you're going to be actually even still there seeing the Treasury yields rise. Treasury yields are not keeping up with inflation. My goodness, you cannot get a safe investment that gives you a positive inflation-adjusted return. The T-bill yields less than the annual rate of inflation, you'd do better to go out and buy a basket of goods and hold it for next year, because you'll be making more money on that than you will buying a treasury bill. That's an unusual circumstance. It's an artificial circumstance, and it's one that is directly rigged by the U.S. Treasury. In terms of the gold market, again, that also gets rigged, but it's your primary hedge against what they're doing to the dollar here. Again, you look at the underlying fundamentals, there's no way that I can see, possibly, and I'd be very happy to have someone come forward and say, oh, here, this is how they're going to do it. No way that the government is not effectively going to be insolvent in the not-too-distant future because of the terrible obligations it has that it's unable to fund. And again, the government is not going to file for bankruptcy. Governments don't do that. What they tend to do, and in fact what you're beginning to see them do, is rather than do that, they just print the money they need to meet their obligations. And with that, you will see inflation rising, irrespective of how it's reported by the government. Their measures will be rising as well. The average people will be seeing it. It isn't a big problem at the moment, I'll grant you that, but it's going to become one. Everything is in place for this to take off. And again, where I said that debt collapse is not deflationary, I didn't quite complete the thought there, and I know we're running late on time, but very simply, when you have the government doing what it's doing, where the bank accounts are guaranteed. Now, they pulled back off of unlimited guarantees by the FDIC, but if you have another crisis, they're going to put that back in place so people don't lose the money in their bank account. So you're not going to have a money supply collapse that you had back in the 30s. The debt collapse does not collapse the money supply. If I'm a bank and I lend you $1 million, but the system is working normally, and it's not working normally at the moment, but that would create $10 million worth of money supply as it's lent out by the banks. It boosts the money supply some. You're not getting the full effect at the moment. Nonetheless, the fellow borrows the money, goes under. The bank wants its $1 million back. It can't get it back from the guy that no longer has it. And it can't pull that cash out of the system. It has no ability to do that so that it doesn't implode the money supply the way the loss of bank accounts did back in the 30s. What happens is you don't get money supply growth. So the banks take a charge on their balance sheet. That restricts their ability, in theory, to lend money. So they cut back on lending, which we've seen. And that cuts back on money supply growth, but it doesn't collapse it. So we've been through a period of slow growth. It's actually beginning to pick up some now. And that's more tied to the Fed actually buying U.S. treasuries than anything else.
Just a qualification, because I see lots of projections in terms of GDP growth statistics, housing starts, you know, are we in recovery, are we not? When it comes to individual asset classes, you know, there's some analysts who see the Dow going to 5,000. There's other analysts who see the Dow going to 30,000. I mean, so obviously, and these are folks with some degree of education backing their opinions. They're coming with very different opinions. Using your alternate CPI, going back to 1980 as the base year, we mentioned 2516 as a new high for gold, or just a match for the old high. Using a more realistic inflation adjustment, you've gone as high as $7,711 for gold, $565 for silver. We're not even talking about getting to those numbers just because we're in a hyperinflation. Those would just reflect a catch-up for the inflation already in the system. Is that what I understand that to be?
What you have to keep in mind here, and this is true with gold, it's true with stocks, it's true with the money supply, you don't necessarily see an immediate one-on-one relationship here. If you go back since the founding of the Fed, the U.S. dollar, based on the CPIU, has lost somewhat in excess of 95% of its purchasing power. If you use my numbers, it's lost over 98%. The same period of time, the dollar against gold has lost 98% of its purchasing power. So from that standpoint, it has acted over the period of a century there as a pretty good store of wealth versus what I think the actual inflation is. You had a period of time where there's been all sorts of, Americans couldn't own gold. Gold has been manipulated. The price was fixed at certain times. But you'll see that the gold has been anticipating a problem here in inflation. I can't tell you what it's going to go to precisely with any given inflation rate, but I can tell you it's going to go a lot higher. Whether you get gold today, if you get gold at 1,500, 2,000, 5,000, 10,000, it'll still be a buy because as the hyperinflation hits, what will happen is that it'll hit 100,000, it'll hit 1,000,000, God knows what it'll hit. But it's not that you're making money on that. What you're doing is you're preserving the purchasing power of the dollars that you put into gold. And when we're in an active inflation market, there tends to be more movement. Depends when people get in. Now you look at the stock market. Stock market also is something of a hedge against inflation. So in a hyperinflation, sure, I could see the Dow at 30,000 or 100,000. But if you adjust it for inflation with this kind of economy that we're in, I'd be looking at a negative return there after inflation adjustment. So I'm not at all a big fan of stocks, at least in this current environment. For the foreseeable future, we do not have a sound economy. We've got a government that effectively is the elephant in the bathtub of sovereign solvency risk, and the rest of the world knows it. It's just a matter of when the markets respond, and I think we're about to do some things in Washington that will bring the problems to the fore in the global markets.
So, John, just to summarize, it sounds like, you know, number one, the economy is not in recovery. The downturn arguably began second or third quarter 2012, what some would argue is a double dip, and the covering over the economic statistics and the distortion in the numbers, whether it's industrial production, GDP, many of these things tie back to this inflation issue, understating inflation and skewing the world around us as a result, so that we don't really understand what is happening. It's almost as if we're looking at the world as you could the Treasury market. It's all to some degree rigged because the statistics that they use to compute growth have been rigged themselves, and so the reality is different. It's very different. What is apparent is not real. What is real is not necessarily apparent today, and that's where an investor has to apply some degree of wisdom in anticipation of those realities coming to the fore. Is that accurate?
That's accurate. I would add, however, that I think the average person has a pretty good sense of reality. Again, they look at the world around them, they look at their business, they look at their community, and they find that what they're seeing is not in line with what the government's saying. Go with your gut. You're seeing the reality out there. The government's having problems reporting it in a meaningful way. They do a good job of surveying generally, but some of the underlying definitions that are designed to make things look a little better politically move it away from the common experience.
Well, John, let's go ahead and come back to this conversation as we get into 2014, maybe as we head towards the end of this year. And, you know, as 2014 represents a period of time where you see transition ahead, major transition, I think it's helpful to appreciate the social and cultural ramifications of a hyperinflation, and would like to explore those with you more as we get towards the end of the year, and look forward to your contribution to our listeners' understanding and the perspicacious actions which they can take in what is a truly challenging time. So thank you, John, for joining us today, and we look forward to our next conversation.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Boy, David, so many things were covered, but, you know, something hit me when he was talking. He said, you know, if Greenspan had not messed with the way they look at CPI, Social Security right now, the payments for Social Security would be twice what they actually are. No wonder people are running out of money before they get to the end of the month.
And it's also an issue because we have not addressed Social Security and Medicare, and it's almost by skewing the numbers. I mean, obviously, we look at our current Social Security issue, our current Medicare issue, as unsustainable. Well, we would have been forced to deal with this long ago.
Sure.
If it had not been manipulated out of view. The reality is we've got a fiscal disaster ahead of us, a fiscal disaster. I mean, when we talked with John today, I mentioned that Stanley Druckenmiller was, yes, this is an issue. This is a major issue. Our long-term liabilities are going to kill this country and kill this economy. We have to address it. The kicking the can down the road has really been accomplished in large part by manipulation of the appearances, manipulation of the statistics, which give us a sense of calm, give us a sense that government is in control, when in fact they're completely out of control. And that, I think, is John's primary concern. We are at a tipping point as we move into 2014, 2015, 2016, where the public, national, domestic, and international, see that the king has no clothes. We've had this problem for a long time, but again, statistics have allowed us to paper over the issues, No longer, says John Williams.
Well, and when that child says that the king has no more clothes on, and the child being the rest of the world, you know, he said $5,000 gold, $10,000 gold, that's still a buy. You have to understand, that's not the issue. The currency's collapsing.
In the context of hyperinflation, as you go from 5 to 10, 10 to 20, 20 to 100 in terms of a per-ounce price for gold. Well, you remember an ounce of silver in the context of the German hyperinflation went from 1 mark to 2 to 3 to 5 to 10, ultimately into the billions of marks. And for anyone who was trying to time an exit, this is where getting out completely was not prudent. Why we've always recommended a reduction strategy, not an exit strategy. Why? Because in the context of a currency extinction event, which is what a hyperinflation really constitutes, you must have insurance through the duration of that event.
Well, and as a reminder, we would encourage our clients to go to shadowstats.com and look at the hyperinflation report. John updates that on a continual basis. And, you know, like he said, this is, in his view, an inevitable outcome.
As you mentioned, Kevin, there is the hyperinflation report, and he also, just open to the public, looks at how the quality of government statistics has been compromised. If you don't have an understanding of that, you must spend some time chewing on that issue to appreciate where we're at today, where we're going tomorrow.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney and our guest today, John Williams. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.